From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, I have a great pleasure of welcoming a local Vermont poet named Michelle Demers, whose new poetry collection is Green Mountain Zen. I want to just do a little introduction first and let you know a little bit about who Michelle is. Michelle Demers holds an MFA in writing from the Vermont College of Fine Arts and teaches poetry and writing from at the Community College of Vermont. She also leads what she calls First Thoughts writing workshops regionally. Her chapbook, Epicenter, won the 2006 Blue Light Poetry Prize. Michelle lives and writes in Williston, Vermont, with her brilliant husband and exceptional cat. I love that that was on your your bio. She's inspired by Vermont's spectacular countryside as well as the deep spiritual questions of life. Here's the publisher's summary of Michelle's new collection. Green Mountain Zen renders the cycles of the human spirit as it surrenders to the shortest, most shut down days of winter, keeping the coals of itself aglow, and then opens to celebration as the earth softens, greens, and again offers its abundance, which we're all enjoying right now as we actually get a little bit of spring going outside. This is a wise book, attentive to the nuances of inner and outer weather in a way that might best be called devotional, patient, and deeply respectful. Image by image, romaine seeds the size of a baby's eyelash, the raindrop that lingers like a diamond in the cup of the lupine's fan-shaped leaf. Demers renders the feel of seasons, much as Chinese painters did through spare, careful brush strokes. This is the perfect book to dream with beside a warm fire or overlooking a harvest-ready garden while morning sun is still fresh and cool. Michelle, welcome to Write the Book. It's really great to have you here.
Great to be here. Happy National Poetry Month.
All right. We're like getting this wonderful poetry conversation in under the wire. But
exactly.
I always like to say that I like the idea of poetry being a year-round occupation. But it's great that they do.
Absolutely. But we get our 1 month.
That's true. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming in to speak with me live in real time and for sharing your beautiful book, Green Mountain Zen, published by Blue Light Press. So I'm going to ask Michelle to read some poems, and we're going to talk about them one by one. Not all of the poems in the collection, obviously, but some of the ones that I was very moved by. But before we have you read something, I wanted to just ask you, the poems do kind of follow the seasons, as that description mentioned, and you decided to start in darkness and move toward light. Do you want to talk about that decision a little
bit? Yeah. I think structuring a book is really a big decision, and I struggled with it for a while, but it seemed to naturally go into a kind of, you know, the obvious yearly cycle.
Yeah.
And I didn't want it to be really cliche, like here's, fall, winter, spring. And the poems didn't really fit into that neat, you know, category so much. I mean, this is Vermont, and there was a lot of winter poems.
Yeah, right.
And that's when I do most of my writing. But I did start out with November and into winter, and then it does move into spring and ends with summer. But it seemed as though it kind of had that natural idea of going into darkness, literally,
right,
and physically,
right,
and then into the light.
Yes.
But those two categories that I split them into also kind of works on the level of a kind of a spiritual sense as well.
Yes.
So I kind of liked that kind of division.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And I will just reiterate what you've just said, and that is that the book actually does have two sections, and they are titled Into Darkness and Into the Light, and there are a number of poems in each. And I liked that you were able to end on the high note of light. You know, I think that's
one of the things that was a definite choice. Yeah.
And it wouldn't have made any sense to start in January and go through December, because then you're kind of going
exactly
from darkness to anyway. Blah,
yeah.
Blah.
Yep.
So anyway, your very first poem in the collection is also called Into Darkness, and mm-hmm. I wondered if we could start with your reading that one.
Sure.
Thank you.
Into Darkness. Toward November, mornings begin late and cold, with a thin sheet of ice on the bird bath. Finches exchange their exuberant gold for a sensible brown, and the field mice ready their burrows. Each morning, I find myself sleeping later, pulled toward a hibernation I must resist, or risk losing vital time to work, to live. Still, the longer nights serve to tamp down my manic frenzy, the hysterical leftovers of an over-caffeinated world. And despite its reputation, darkness soothes the cranked-up life lived at warp speed. Welcome, darkness. Wrap us in the comfort of the coming winter, when we can rest, take in the solstice, absorb strength from silence. And after the dark lifts, we will reemerge and walk forward with bouquets of fire in our hands.
Thank you for reading that. There's so much about that I love as a first poem in this collection. I wonder how it became the opening poem of the collection. I mean, when you wrote this, were you already planning a collection, or was this?
I wasn't. Actually, what precipitated the collection was the title poem, Green Mountain Zen. And I was in this online poetry workshop, and I had written the poem, and it was actually titled something else. It might have been New England Zen or something like that. And I started getting feedback online, and someone made the comment, "I like your New England Zen," or something like that. And then someone else said, "Oh, that sounds like the title of a book." Mm-hmm. And so then I started thinking, well, maybe I should put together a collection. And I'm from New England, so New England seemed to fit. And for a long time, that was the title of the book, New England Zen. I liked the sound of it, New England. But then when I started reading it more and I gave it to other people to read to give me feedback, actually it came back from someone and said, I liked Green Mountain Zen. And I'm like, oh, that's not the title, but I kind of like that better. And it started to make more sense to me that Green Mountain has an image to it. And really, the poems are about Vermont.
Yeah.
They're really not about Rhode Island and Massachusetts, even though I'm from there.
Okay.
So even though it kind of shrinks my audience a little bit, Green Mountain Zen seems to make more sense.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
As far as the beginning of it, that's when I started structuring the manuscript around Green Mountain Zen, and it seemed to make sense. And this was a pretty good poem about November, because November's a downer.
But let's talk about that, because I love this line. I'm not going to read the whole line, but despite its reputation, darkness soothes. And in fact, I loved that, because I think that, I don't know, I think some people find that as we move into winter, it's quite depressing. But there is something very soothing about embraced by the darkness and
calming down.
Relaxing, slowing down.
More.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. Did this poem get written for the collection, or had you already written it?
I had just a whole bunch of poems that were floating around that I'd been just collecting for years.
Mm.
And then when I decided to start putting together a collection, I just started gathering them and refining them. I think there were only a couple that I actually wrote for the collection that seemed to need to be filled in here and there. But I don't know. I didn't write for the collection. I just kind of pulled stuff together, threw stuff out.
One thing, it's funny, I don't know if this is a near rhyme or not, but one thing that did jump out at me were the words tamp and manic, which come together. Where's that line?
Mm-hmm. Second stanza, yeah.
Yes. Right. The longer nights serve to tamp down my manic frenzy. And I was thinking, that's kind of a near rhyme.
Mm-hmm.
And was that purposeful? Do you remember?
Well, everything is purposeful in poetry.
Right.
It's like Samuel Taylor Coleridge defines poetry as the best possible words in the best possible order. So you have to think about every single word. So absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like I must resist or risk. You know, all of that's very intentional.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. What is the form of this poem, would you say?
I generally write in free verse. So, some of the ones I'll read that you had selected are in a form, but I tend to write more in free verse. I like the openness of it. I can let the poem go where it wants to go and let it be more organic, so it doesn't have a specific
Right.
Form.
But you do have like an end of cold and then two lines later an end of gold. And so there mm-hmm. are these moments that mm-hmm. feel a little bit like they are influenced by formality, although they aren't.
Oh, absolutely.
Of a certain form.
Yeah, absolutely. And because it's free verse doesn't mean that it's a free-for-all.
Right.
I mean, there are still...
It's still very intentional.
Rules, right.
Yeah.
And it's informed by the language, so, yeah.
Okay. All right,
I'm glad you picked that up, though.
Do you want to read another one?
Yeah, sure.
How about December?
Okay. Now, this one is a form. It's called a pontoum, and you'll hear the repetition. I kind of like this form. It's just kind of interesting and fun. It's written in quatrains, four-line stanzas, and if you were looking at it, you would see that the second and fourth line in the first stanza becomes the first and third of the next. So sometimes I describe it as sort of like a slinky going down the stairs.
Oh,
and
I love that.
It kind of repeats. December. This is the taste of what has been lost, crushed by the heaviness of winter skies. I am a daughter of the dark earth. Everything must be forgiven, like debts. Crushed by the heaviness of winter skies, we gradually wear away our false outer skins. Everything must be forgiven, like debts. A tang of black tea lingers in the throat. We gradually wear away our false outer skins. After all, how is happiness created? A tang of black tea lingers in the throat, like a slow walk through bare maple groves. Above all, how is happiness created? I am a daughter of the dark earth. I walk slowly through bare maple groves. This is the taste of what has been lost.
Mm, I love a pontoum. I think it's so cool.
Yeah, it's really a fun poem. And when I teach, I like to teach my students this because when you write it, like half, you write the first stanza and like half of them are already done for
right.
the next stanza.
Right. And then some of them don't repeat exactly.
Right.
And is that
you can
true
have a little,
for a lot of poets?
Oh, sure. You take license with that.
Yeah. Do you find that when you're working certain subject matter will kind of invite certain treatment of form? Or do you think that that's not necessarily related for you?
I think it's very organic.
Okay.
You know, I think it takes a little bit of patience to work with the poem and kind of let it decide what it wants to be in
right.
some ways.
Right.
I don't like to sort of shoehorn a form, you know, a poem into a form. I think it has to kind of lend itself to a certain form, but I think for every poet it's very different.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, do you actually remember writing this particular poem?
I think this one was from a prompt. I had gotten a prompt from some book, and because I love prompts and I use prompts all the time, and I think it might even be the first line. This is the taste of what has been lost, or I might have altered it a little bit. This is kind of an older poem, but yeah. I still like it.
I loved it. I want to ask you a little bit about what you do with your poems. When you think a poem is finished, do you tend to submit to journals all the time? Do you submit to contests? What do you do?
I should do all that stuff. Some of them I do. I've sent some out. And I'll once in a while go through this big flurry of activity and send a bunch of poems out and then just wait until they all come back.
Right.
But, you know, I should be a lot more ambitious about sending my poems out, but maybe I will soon.
Have some of these appeared in journals?
Yeah, a couple of them. The haiku one that you picked out there were actually five to begin with, and now there are just three, was published in a local journal, and there was the one about the strawberry moon that was published in, I can't remember the name of it, but yeah, not many.
Okay. Why don't we, let's see. Do you want to read the haiku one right now?
Yeah, sure. So we're now into summer. So we're moving around in the seasons.
We're
going to
move
bit.
Around in the seasons a little bit.
So because I'm a gardener, these things, I tend to write a lot about gardening. So this is called Garden Journal 3 Haiku. Large, round pea seeds planted deep, 2 inches apart, love cold soil. Red Admiral Butterfly visits while I plant squash. He flirts, I rest. I set large tomato cages over small young seedlings. Soon they'll try to escape.
That's great. So yes, those are three haiku. So do you want to just tell me again what the haiku rule is?
Well, everyone's kind of fixated on this rule of five syllables, seven syllables, five. And I don't follow those rules exactly because the Japanese, they're very regimented about the way they use their language, and it fits into their language in that format. But when we go to English, and a lot of people do try to make it in that format, I think the more important thing when you're writing haiku is the leap that takes place between line two and line three. Mm-hmm. So as long as there's sort of this ah feeling, like, I set large tomato cages over small young seedlings. Soon they'll try to escape. Mm-hmm. There's just that sort of little moment there. And I think that's, to me, that is the key to haiku.
And I should say that Michelle has been on Write the Book once before because you taught a class in another Japanese form called the tanka.
That's right.
And I recorded that class. That was so much fun. And I actually did broadcast that on the show many years ago. So that's available on the podcast site if you look up tanka, T-A-N-K-A, I believe you'll
Which
be able to find it.
Which is also a lot of fun to write.
Another one. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so I'm going to take us back to winter here.
Okay.
Sorry to make everyone jump around so much. I wonder if you could read Snap.
So here's another one that's actually in a form. And again, I don't write in form very much, but I like this one. This is called a huzzle. A lot of people tend to pronounce it guzzle because it's spelled G-H-A-Z-A-L. But I remember hearing the poet Shahid Ali read at Breadloaf one year, and this was his form. And he talked about it, he lectured about it, and he said it's huzzle. So I made sure I pronounced it correctly. But it's in couplets, and one feature of this form is there's a repetition at the end of the line, and you'll hear it. It's Vermont in this case. And the poet usually puts their own name in, and so I put it in at the end. So this is called Snap. We haven't felt a cold this deep in years. Not this eye-tearing, face-numbing, pipe-bursting cold of Vermont. When wool-hatted heads are lowered, shoulders raised against the bone-freezing winds of Vermont. The finches puff out their winter-brown feathers. The Labradors dance to protect paws in the steely cold of Vermont. Nights I sleep in woolly socks and huddle under flannel while endless darkness tells the story of Vermont. The company of stars and wolf moon keep me from shattering amid harsh fields of ice and stoic mountains of Vermont. In the morning, sub-zero temps turn the air whitish gray. A magnificent calm defines itself, Vermont. In my mind, I plan the spring garden that today lies hard and frozen under dried autumn leaves of Vermont. Will early spinach rise when the frozen ground thaws? The soil will answer. Survival is the promise of Vermont. What is hope, after all, if not the idea of crocus and tulip, if not the brown hare feeding in the early morning in Vermont? And what of the long stretches of silence that echo Michelle in my dreams? Is it Nirvana or Vermont?
Nice, nice. I like having you read it out loud, and I can read it along with you and see things I didn't see when I was just reading it quietly. I love that one line, a magnificent calm defines itself, and then you've got a colon, Vermont. And that one does not have a preposition next to it. You have of Vermonts and in Vermonts. Mm-hmm. And that's right in the middle of the poem. So in a way, that kind of separates something. Yeah, it turns right there, and I liked that. And then the end is a little different because you've got a couple questions at the end there. Mm-hmm.
I like reading it out loud, too, because it sounds different to me when I read it out loud, too. And I tell my students all the time, you've got to read your work out loud because it really changes things. So And that's why going to poetry readings is so wonderful.
Yeah.
Because you get to hear the poem read in the poet's voice.
Yeah.
So I always tell people, like, go to readings. It's really exciting.
And you have, I know you weren't looking for this, but I'm just going to say you have a lovely reading style of your poetry. You know, sometimes you hear poets read and it's very, you know, I think it's intended to be very hypnotic, but sometimes mm-hmm. it becomes almost kind of cumbersome.
Right.
And that's not my favorite style. Okay. And then I just wanted to mention the kind of the value of refrain. Like, so the way that you repeated that Vermont, and I know that's part of the form that you were, the chazal. Mm-hmm. But, you know, do you have thoughts on that? Like, what that does for the reader?
It kind of anchors the poem a little bit, mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm. It sort of lands there.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting form, and not all chazals are exactly like this.
Right.
I mean, there is that repetition, but, you know, there's variations of it, but those are kind of the basic rules around it.
Yeah.
And you should pick a word that you like saying if you're going to repeat it a lot.
Yeah. So. And it's fun to read, too, because you kind of wonder, well, how's she going to, what else is she going to present that can still use that?
Right.
You know, yeah.
It's fun.
Yeah, it is. What was the process of getting this published? Did you submit it to Blue Light or did you submit it to a contest? I know you won a contest.
Well, I was really fortunate because you mentioned at the beginning that I had a chapbook, Epicenter, mm-hmm. that had won a chapbook contest.
Right.
And that was published by Blue Light Press. And I've had a long association with Blue Light Press. It's run by Diane Frank, who was actually my first real poetry teacher.
Mm.
When I went to grad school for my first master's, she taught poetry, and I had to take a poetry class, even though it was a master's in professional writing.
Oh, okay.
And we all had to take poetry, and I was like, okay, I'll just get through this. And it totally opened me up to a whole new realm that I didn't even realize I liked.
That's amazing.
And she was so affirming in the way that she taught. So I kept at it, and I just kept studying and studying. And so she encouraged me to send my work, and I did win the contest in 2006. And the online workshop that I often take is run by her.
Mm-hmm.
And so she had been seeing my poems all along, and she at one point finally said, I think you have enough for a collection. You should send me something. So it was really her encouragement.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, and it's really an amazing thing to have someone like that. I feel very fortunate. I think it was Natalie Goldberg that once said, at some point, somebody has to give you permission. And she gave me permission to write poems, because I never took myself seriously before then. So
it sounds like she gave you permission to write poems and then to publish them and show
exactly.
them to people.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
she's a real champion of emerging poets.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Where is Blue Light Press anyway?
San Francisco.
Oh, okay. Great.
So I'm going out there next summer to give a reading.
Oh, nice. Oh, that'll be great.
Yeah.
Let's see. Do you want to read? How about Into the Vast?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Into the Vast. For 2 hours now, midday sun, hidden behind snow clouds, clings to the idea of warmth. Even in February, when stones hold tight to silence and mountains show inexhaustible patience with rime ice and jet stream winds. As though blessing us, clouds finally part, signaling storms end. We begin to let our shoulders drop and breathe in whatever energy we can from the glow. Fortified by a thin radiance, we pick ourselves up, gather the power of fire within, and move forward into the vast illumination, undaunted by the knowledge that the way forward could blind us, even as it lights our path.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I want to mention that this poem has its words on the page in a different, you know, they're not all left justified. They are
a lot of indentations.
Yeah, they're indented more. And
right.
It's funny because it to me, and maybe I was just being moved by the subject matter, but it looked almost like they were blown across the page a little bit.
Yeah, kind of. And I think that's the fun part of poetry. You can really use the page mm-hmm. in a whole different way than mm-hmm. just, you know, sentences and paragraphs.
Right. Now, so how do you decide what to do with an indent? And I mean, that's probably a big question. And it's also kind of obscure because we're not talking specifically, but like Snow Clouds is indented once, and even in February is indented twice. Mm-hmm. I don't know, like...
So you, again, it's just a matter of playing with it a lot, seeing what you want to stand out. Like Snow Clouds is kind of, I made it one word, so it's kind of an interesting word. So I thought stand by itself.
There's another one in here. I don't think it's one that I mentioned for you to read, but there's one called Buried that like makes an actual triangle.
It's playing with
words,
typography.
Yeah, the words are kind of buried under each other. That was the point on that one. I wanted to ask you about titling poems. So, for example, the poem that you read a minute ago, Snap, that word doesn't appear in the poem, I don't believe. And I love that. I love that you're giving us a title that then it kind of informs the poem without necessarily. Sure. And then sometimes a title is the first line of a poem. And in this case, Into the Vast... It sounds one way as a title, but then when it's in the actual poem, it's used in a different way,
right?
Because Into the Vast has a subject that's following, which was
Illumination.
So, do you want to talk a little bit about coming up with titles?
Well, this is kind of my dirty little secret about titles. I tell my students this, and I always tell them that they have to title their poems. Uh-huh. They can't just leave it untitled or, you know, just, you know, nothing at all. But I end up, my process is to write in my notebook until something really starts to gel. And then I think, oh, this could be a poem. Then I put it in my notebook, on my computer and type it up and kind of start playing with it. And at some point I just have to close it. So, you know, when you close a document, it tells you you need a title.
Right.
So at that point, I'm like, okay, what am I going to title this? And sometimes I just give it a working title, but other times I try to come up with something.
Right.
And this one actually is just sort of a little gamey thing that I heard. I think it might have been at Vermont College of Fine Arts. Somebody was giving a lecture, and they said, oh, the way they title their poems is you count five lines up from the bottom and on the edge, and this one's actually six, and you use that. And so I'm like, that looks good. And it turned out to work. And sometimes it works and other times it doesn't. But I thought, well, that's a trick.
Yeah, I like that.
But it should, you know, I like it to work on a couple of levels. And this Into the Vast seemed to work on that sort of level of expansion and transcendence as well as, you know, going into the actual seasons or a snowstorm or something like that.
Okay. All right. Do you find that poems begin in similar ways for you, or is it always different? Like, does it tend to be an object? Well, you said you use prompts.
Yeah.
What inspires you? I mean, what makes you pick up the pen more than anything else, do you think?
I just am starting to realize that, I guess as a poet, you have to pay attention.
Yes.
And just paying attention to everything, paying attention to living and doing and you know, seeing, you know, the ant on a flower or whatever.
Right.
And then when you sit down, it might appear in your notebook. But it's hard to say what will actually, you know, create a poem itself.
Yes.
I tell my students that actually the times that inspire me most are in the car and in the shower. Times when I don't have my notebook with me and something appears, I'm like, oh, that would really make a good image or a good line. And sometimes I have to pull over. But
I read an article once that actually looked at the science of why that's true.
I think there is something.
Yeah, there's a way that your brain gets released from to kind of go down creative pathways when it's, you know, I don't know, when the pen is unavailable.
Right. It works.
Yeah. I loved, there's one of the poems, probably several of them, but in particular, Winter Walk has like a narrative moment within the poem, which I always sort of enjoy that. I wonder if you'd mind reading that one.
Sure. Winter Walk. My boots crunch on squeaky snow, but all other sounds are muted, smothered. Above the silence and the footsteps, my thoughts whisper while I walk in the middle of the day. Urgently, they say we are meant to make sense of the world alone, but they lie. We connect with each other by design or lucky accident. At the end of the road, a huge blackbird lifts, its caws splitting the frozen air into particles, shattering my inner chatter like a koan. For a fraction of a second, my breath stops. The wide onyx wings shoot through the white landscape, transporting us both straight into the center of this life.
Thank you. I love that. And I wanted to talk about that. There is kind of a narrative moment. It's kind of a little bit of a story. There's the walk, and then there's the kind of musings on the walk. But then there's this thing that happens that's a surprise. But one thing I particularly loved is that the physicality of the bird and the physicality of your reaction are kind of blended together on juxtaposed lines, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for a fraction of a second, my breath stops, the wide onyx wings shoot, you know. So it's like those are two different actors on the stage, right?
Yeah.
And that's very physical, those two moments together next to each other. And I remember a teacher once gave a lecture. It was... I think it was Sharon Sheehy Stark, and she gave a lecture at Vermont College, and she was talking about basic things to look for in your writing and fix. And she said one of the things that she always tells her stories is not to have overactive body parts.
That's funny.
I wish I could come up with a good example of it, but you don't do it, so I'm not. But sometimes I think beginning writers will have, like, the description of a physical moment is overdone. Like, you just don't need to know that much about this moment in time.
TMI.
You know? Yeah, you're right. But that was a lovely, lovely treatment of a physical moment, and it also involved two different beings at the same time, which I really liked. And I also love the birds in this collection. And it seems like in addition to gardening, you're very much
a
watcher of birds. And birds are so much a part of the cycle of seasons up here.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So that was great. How could you read to the snows of early spring?
Yeah. To the snows of early spring. And there's an epigraph at the beginning after Li Qing Chao from the Song Dynasty. Thin gray skies, thick ice clings to roadside cliffs, patches of brown grass beneath tiny snowflakes. Even though light now floods end of day, daffodils bloom briefly, wilt swiftly. Regret tastes like bitter greens, this brief life. How can this moment break open the sunflower seed?
Thank you. It's funny, that one, it kind of evoked David Budbill for me.
Yeah, definitely. And I get inspired by his stuff.
Yeah, and he's inspired very often by the Japanese poets, too.
Mm-hmm. Chinese and Japanese,
right. It's funny because I wanted to ask you about writing after another poet, like the epigraph is after Li Qing.
Right.
So is that something, I mean, that sounds like something that you set out to do, like you...
It's deliberate. It's like an imitation poem. So this poem structurally looked like another poem that I liked by this poet, Li Qing Chao. And Chinese poets write a lot about nature too, so it's probably a nature poem, but all the words are mine. So I kind of just used the structure and the way the lines are on the page. There are big indents, and then there's kind of that turn at the end that says this brief life kind of is like sort of an epiphany in the poem. Only his was different. I can't remember what it was now. So whenever you're kind of using that much of another poet's work, you like to give them a little bit of a nod.
Yeah.
I borrowed this from you, even though it's still my voice and my words, but I kind of used that structure. And the ideas, too, I mean, I wouldn't normally write like this. So it gave me some interesting ways to work with the language that I normally wouldn't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, do you ever assign your students, a certain poet to try to emulate or to try to give a nod to?
When I teach creative writing and an intro to poetry course. And when we're doing the intro to poetry course, we have more time and we could do something like that. With creative writing, we only have about 5 weeks of poetry.
Right.
And I kind of want to stick to the basics. But I think working with other poets' work is a wonderful way for them to see how other poets use language.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, and in fact, every week I make them write what I call an anthology, which is to take another poet's work and just write it out by hand.
Oh, wow.
Because it makes them slow down and really look at the language and see just where the commas are, how the line ends. And I tell them it's the difference between reading a poem and writing it out longhand is like the difference between driving through a neighborhood and walking through a neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you drive through, you kind of just see the traffic lights and other cars. But when you're walking through, you might notice, you know, a geranium in someone's window or a crack in the sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
And so you really have to focus in. And it seems like a almost silly exercise to write mm-hmm. it out longhand. But I got it from when I went to Vermont Studio Center 1 year, and Robert Pinsky was there.
Oh, wow.
Before he was poet laureate. And he was the one that told us to do that. And I thought, well, if it comes from him, it's got to be a good thing.
Yeah.
So I practice it myself all the time. I think it's a really useful thing, and it's much easier to do with poems than novels.
Yeah, definitely. I'm just going to interrupt us for a second and say listeners are listening to WBTV LP Burlington 99.3 FM, and we are streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is an interview with Vermont poet Michelle Demers. And if you're enjoying our conversation, please rate the show in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and especially help spread the word about Write the Book, because the more writers that get to hear the show, the more our words might inspire and help somebody who's trying to write. So the first poem in the Into the Light section is your title poem, Green Mountain Zen. How would you feel about reading that one now?
I would love to. Green Mountain Zen. The roads crack open with frost heaves, white with dried salt, swollen from melting snow, then refrozen, asphalt bulging. In the air above naked trees, a woodpecker, its head blazing, fights warming winds in the slow light of morning. Wood ducks navigate the river's ice flows in a treacherous current, and no words are strong enough to stop the world from thawing. In the near distance, dark blue storm clouds threaten the persistence of wind chills. March is the month of melancholy, with its roadside snow, dirty and tired. Yet buried beneath, white trilliums sleep, each with their three shy petals waiting for their moment, brilliant and forgiving.
The trilliums are so wonderful.
Love
when you
those.
Go, you know, you go for a walk and you're like, it's flowers.
I know. It's so exciting.
Wow.
And when you live in Vermont, those are the things that excite you.
Absolutely. Now, let's see. I wanted to just ask you, we've already talked about this poem because this is your title poem, so I know. But I had something I was going to say, and now it's gone. Oh, I know. You've got some alliteration in here, and I know that that's probably in a lot of your poems, but let's talk a little bit about that and the sort of the beauty of that and the way it can be used to kind of evoke a feeling. But I assume, too, you have to be careful not to overdo it. So
mm-hmm.
do you want to just talk a little bit about alliteration?
Yeah. I think, you know, having a delicate hand with it is always a good idea. When I first teach it, you know, I really talk a lot about how important sound is, especially with free verse, because it's really one of your tools. If you're not using a specific form that uses a rhyme at the end of each line, but sound can be always used throughout a poem, and then they go crazy with it.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, it's a little too much here, so you have to pull back a little bit.
Right.
So you kind of have to be careful with it, but.
Yeah, and so the example I'm looking at here is March is the month of melancholy.
Yeah,
but then
a lot of M's.
Yeah, but then your next line is, with its roadside snow, dirty and tired, and not a single one of those words starts with M or repeats any other letter. So it kind of keeps it light, keeps it from getting bogged down in
Lets it stand out a little bit, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I always remember in that movie Broadcast News. Do you remember that line? I'm trying to remember. I think it's Albert Brooks, and he's like, a lot of alliteration from anxious anchors.
Yes, I know. I love that.
Such
it's a great
funny movie.
Movie.
Okay, how about Weather Report, March 20? I loved this. I loved this one.
Weather Report, March 20th. The day is equinoxed with squalls. One is a loosely woven fabric, one a sap moon. We explore the earth like peepers, awakening, hollowed and anxious. The night is tight and hoary. The night is a fox. Before us, a slippery patron of hunger. Bring us a mild cup of fennel tea. We have few spongy carrots left in the bin. We do not ask, although we lick our lips. Maples are squeezed by plastic tubing. Our names are mountain, mole, and hare. We travel the still congealed ground and try to breathe the soil.
Thank you so much. So this poem, I absolutely loved it. It evokes a kind of feeling of March 20th-ness.
In Vermont.
In Vermont. It's also, you know, because it's written in short sort of declarative sentences, it feels like it's a story or a sort of... it feels more literate than it is. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to take all of this that.
Well, the syntax is a little different than what I usually write.
Yes.
They're not normal sentences. So that might make them stand out a little bit more.
And it's also very, you know, it's very creative. It's just, it's taking us into a very interesting place. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. I can't explain it better than that. You know, like spongy carrots left in the bin, that's very specific and universal. We've all had that experience.
Yeah.
But equinoxed with squalls is so like wonderfully different, you know. So
yeah, it's fun to play with verbs like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I don't know if I have a question here, but I just I don't know. It's fun.
Again, and that one too, I remember working on this one a long time and really just kind of letting all the rules go. Playing around with the language a lot, and so I'm glad it works for you.
Yeah, it does, definitely.
Because it's a little unusual from the other poems.
Yeah, but that's also fun.
Yeah.
Let's see. How about you have one after Charles Wright called Red?
Yeah. I think his was white. He used white.
Okay.
I use red. Red. Red is for waking up, the jolt, the blood recognition. The blackbird's wing, that red, the return of light, heart music, the red of obsession, the red of foxes, their red backs, the fierce red of birth, clairvoyant red, the red of sunrise, the unexpected red, singing for her and for him, the red of Mars, not far from a waning gibbous moon, the red of what is miraculous, red of peony, red of claw, the red of motion, the red inside arteries, the red of berries, their wine stain, sumac red, furry seeds, the red of the cardinal, the water, the open door.
Great.
I love repetition.
Yeah.
There's something about it that livens a poem.
Was it just the color that you were inspired from his poem, or was there something more formal also going on that we wouldn't know without reading his?
Yeah, no, it was just the color.
Yeah, okay.
And just so much of it.
Right.
It's just like, how can someone do that and get away with it? So I thought, well, I'm going to try it and see if I can get away with
it. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
And did you stumble across his poem and then decide to write from it right away, or is that a favorite one of yours?
I like Charles Wright generally, and it might have even happened when we were in grad school, and I used some of his poems for either my lecture or I can't remember what. I was reading a lot of him at some point, and I ran across that poem and just wanted to try it.
Yeah.
So,
and we should mention that we went to grad school together.
We did.
So we've known each other
well. Yes, I know.
And we went to Breadloaf together that same summer that Who did you mention?
David Shields.
No, Shahid Ali.
Oh, Shahid Ali. You saw him there, too.
We were there at the same time, I think, that time.
Okay,
yeah,
great.
Yeah,
anyway. Yeah, he's amazing.
So now that we're mentioning lots of different poets, I wonder if you want to talk a little bit about what you've read lately that you might recommend to listeners. It can be poetry or prose or whatever you might...
Yeah, I think reading, it's like the other half of writing. You just have to read a lot. So I tend to read quite a bit. And I've been reading more kind of local poets lately. I just discovered Alison Prine. I know she's been around for a while, but I just read her book, Steel.
Yeah.
Totally loved it. I can't wait for her next book to come out. Shandell Beers has a new book, Secure Your Own Mask. She's also Vermont College of Fine Arts.
Yeah. And, she's an incredible poet.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And she's very ambitious. I mean, she's got a lot of books out already and really gets her name out a lot. But this book is terrific. And my teacher, Diane Frank, has a new one. She's written a lot of books. It's called Canon for Bears and Ponderosa Pines.
Oh,
it's terrific. I've also been reading Ada Limone. I saw her at one of the residencies maybe last winter or something. I like to go down for readings. And I heard her read, and I fell in love with her, and I thought, I have to read more of her work. And I read Sharks in the River, and she's got a new one, The Carrying.
Okay.
But love her work.
Oh, I'll have to look.
I think you'd like her a lot. And I also love Dorian Lux. I just read Only as the Day is Long. That's her newest one. Kim Adonisio, What is This Thing Called Love? And I like reading about writers, too.
Yeah.
And whenever there's a good memoir about a writer's life, I love reading it. I just read Richard Blanco's memoir, The Prince of Los Cucuyos.
Uh-huh.
It's really great.
Yeah.
I really loved it. And I just bought and haven't read yet Carolyn Forché's new memoir, What You Have Heard is True. So I'm looking forward to that. I've heard people are kind of chatting about that one and that it's really good. And Tony Hoagland died this year, which is really a sad thing. And I just loved his work so much. But I saw that he was writing poems like, I swear, like the day before he died. He's amazing. But he put out a book called The Art of Voice. And it's kind of more of it's called Poetic Principles in Practice.
Uh-huh.
So there's like sort of mini lectures and exercises, which I totally obsess over and love. So I'm kind of working my way through that too. But
and does it have some of his poetry in it as well? Or is
not
it mostly
so much.
Just instructive?
It's really more, you know, an instructive book.
Yeah.
And he might refer to other
poems.
But
how wonderful that is out there now.
Yeah. I know. It's a gift.
Yeah.
It's a real gift.
Well,
but yeah, it's so much to read.
You mentioned at the start of our talk that you tend to write more in the winter. So are you coming into a time where you're not writing very much right now because you're going to be gardening? Or
kind of. I mean, and actually teaching just takes so much out of me that I don't write quite as much when I'm teaching. You know, maybe in between semesters I'll write. And yes, I'll be out in the garden soon, so not writing quite as much then. But, you know, and we're inside so much in the winter. It's just it's an easier time to, you know, I'm not a big skier and things like that. So I tend to be inside and do my writing there.
Yeah.
But
my
friend, Ronnelly Crocker rather, who did the cover.
I was going to ask you about the cover.
Yeah. I asked her, I went to college with her in Boston and, she's still a very prolific painter and asked her if she, you know, had anything I could use. And so she said, yeah, I think, why don't you send me your manuscript and I'll take a look. So I did send it to her. I kind of just briefly described what it was. And so I called her a few weeks later and just said, well, what do you think? And she said, oh, I was reading through your poems. I really like them. And she said, most of these poems are about winter. And I said, finally, I live in Vermont, remember?
I wouldn't say most, though.
No, there's a good chunk of them, though. It was tricky to find a good summer poem, so I did that long one at the end.
Yes. that was great because it follows the alphabet, which is really fun.
Abacadarian.
It's a little long to read on the show.
Yes.
I was going to ask you to read one more poem, though.
Sure.
And that is What Brings Us to Our Knees.
Oh, yeah.
I love this poem. And then I have one last question for you after that.
Okay. What Brings Us to Our Knees. A mother robin nesting in the rhododendron, the anxious worry, the gray raining skies day after day, the crush and burn of us, our quotidian lives, broken sleep, our powdery thoughts, the drunk dance of the bumblebee, First barefoot steps in new grass, our wormy toes and bony knees, our hunger for meaning, our seedlings hiding below the surface, our calm exteriors and rippling interiors. What drops us to the damp earth, makes us collapse as the spring green of buds, and what buckles our stance when the first hummingbird arrives to drink the nectar? Who will see the crumpled pile of us, the aching joy of us? Who will smell the lilacs when we erupt with wonder?
Great. Thank you very much. Now, you mentioned that you had this teacher who was so inspiring to you.
Diane Frank,
that
yes.
You started to write at some point. And so as a teacher and somebody speaking to listeners who are writers, I wonder if you have any advice for people who want to write their first poem.
Wow.
Start writing poetry.
Yeah. I would say don't worry about the form so much. You know, just kind of write in your notebook, pay attention to the world, and just let go for a while and then see what happens. And after a while, it's good to have some instruction, to have someone guide you. But if you sit down with the intention of creating a poem, I don't know about most people, but to me that makes me freeze up.
Yeah.
That I have to craft this beautiful act of literature.
Yeah.
And it's never gonna come out that way.
Right.
So I think letting go of any strictness around your writing is very helpful, and just kind of letting the flow happen. And then cleaning it up later and working on the craft and learning the craft. Yeah, it's important to
right.
learn that too. But I think at the beginning, to not put those holds on you is very important.
Right. Okay,
yeah,
that's
read
wonderful.
A lot of it.
Wonderful advice. So I want to mention again that my guest has been Michelle Demers. Her book is Green Mountain Zen, published by Blue Light Press. If you want to learn more information about Michelle's book, you can find it on the Blue Light Press website. Michelle, thank you so much for being here. It's been a pleasure.
It's been wonderful to be here. Thank you so much.
If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at ratethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. And you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to ratethebook@gmail.com. If you're listening, you probably already know that the show now airs every Monday from 4 to 5. We've made a little bit of a change. We used to be on starting at 3, now it's at 4. And next week, my guest will be the author Stephen Wingate, whose latest is Of Fathers and Fire, published by University of Nebraska Press. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.